Los Angeles, California, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. With the recent stories of strife between U.S. intelligence agencies and the White House, a new timely book sheds light on internal strife and corruption within the CIA. Melvin A. Goodman, a CIA analyst and division chief from 1966 to 1990, has written a new book called Whistleblower at the CIA, an insider's account of the politics of intelligence. I had an in-depth hour-long conversation with Mr. Goodman at Vroman's Bookstore in Pasadena about his book, and today we'll bring you that conversation. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. Melvin Goodman's long career as a respected intelligence analyst at the CIA, specializing in U.S.-Soviet relations, ended abruptly. In 1990, after 24 years of service, Goodman resigned when he could no longer tolerate the corruption he witnessed at the highest levels of the agency. In 1991, he went public, blowing the whistle on top-level officials and leading the opposition against the appointment of Robert Gates as CIA director. In the widely covered Senate hearings that followed, Goodman charged that Gates and others had subverted, quote, the process and the ethics of intelligence by deliberately misinforming the White House about major world events and covert operations. In a new expose called Whistleblower at the CIA, Goodman tells the whole story. Retracing his career with the CIA, he presents a rare insider's account of the inner workings of the United States intelligence community and the corruption, intimidation, and misinformation that led to disastrous foreign interventions. The book is a deep and historical look into one of the most secretive and influential agencies of the U.S. government, and its author wants it to be a wake-up call for the need for reform. Melvin Goodman was a senior analyst and division chief at the CIA from 1966 to 1990. He's an expert on U.S.-Russia relations. His writings have appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, Harper's, and more. He's the author of 6 books on U.S. intelligence and international security. And we now discuss his book, Whistleblower at the CIA, an insider's account of the politics of intelligence. On June 26th, 2017, I spoke with him about his book at Vroman's Bookstore in Pasadena in front of a live audience. Today, we bring you that hour-long conversation.
Welcome. Welcome to our program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So I wanted to start at the beginning because there is such a great interest right now in how our intelligence agencies are functioning, and you write in your book about President Truman's creation of the CIA, and I'm wondering if you can, first of all, share what his motivation was, what the agency was actually meant to do, and did it adhere to its mission?
Sure, that's a very good starting point. In 1947, Harry Truman was responsible for the National Security Act. It was a very short act, only about 6 or 7 pages long. It created the Air Force as an independent service. It created the National Security Council and the Department of Defense as we know it, and finally the Central Intelligence Agency. So when you think about the national security architecture that we have in this country for decision making and implementation of decisions, really the National Security Act of 1947 is the architectural guideline to how we conduct our foreign policy. And you could make the case that given the problems we've had in foreign policy, maybe it's the time to re-examine that architecture, but that's another issue. Truman's point with regard to the CIA was very basic. And I lectured at the Truman Library a couple years ago, and the head archivist took me into his office after my talk and gave me a copy of a note that Harry Truman wrote in his own hand in December 1963. And basically, it was his argument with what the CIA had become. Now, he didn't mention Eisenhower by name, and he didn't mention Kennedy by name. But it was clear that he felt they misused the CIA. In this note, he said he wanted the Central Intelligence Agency to collect intelligence and analyze intelligence. He did not want, and this was an exact quote, he did not want a cloak and dagger organization. So with Eisenhower, beginning in 1953, Operation Ajax, that was British MI6 and the Central Intelligence Agency, combined to overthrow the democratically elected government of Iran. Mossadegh was the leader of Iran at that time. And the CIA and MI6 installed the Shah of Iran, the corrupt Shah of Iran, onto the Peacock throne. So when you think about Iran today, you have to see it in the context of the United States and its deceit in overthrowing a democratically elected government. Later in the 1950s, Eisenhower gave authorization for the assassination of Lumumba in the Congo. The CIA didn't carry out the mission because Belgian intelligence got to Lumumba before the CIA could, but that was responsible for introducing the worst tyrant in the history of Africa, Mobutu. And then, of course, in 1961, to complete this picture that Truman basically was addressing, you had Kennedy being responsible for the outrageous Bay of Pigs. And even the CIA, when they gave its review of the Bay of Pigs operation in the report that followed the operation, they referred to it as the perfect failure. So Truman's complaint was the intelligence agency he wanted had been corrupted, and had been corrupted by two presidents. And before he died, he gave an oral history interview with Merle Miller, and he said something very profound. If I knew then what I know now about the Central Intelligence Agency, I would not have created it.
So this is the history of the CIA in those early years of its formation. You joined the CIA in the 1960s. In your book, you say you were a self-confessed progressive. And were you aware at the time that you joined of the CIA's role in overthrowing Mossadegh in Iran and even, for example, in 1954, the coup in Guatemala? Did those bloody interventions, were you aware of them, and did they have any impact on your decision to join the CIA?
Well, obviously they had no impact. I was clearly aware of it. I lost a lot of good friends. My progressive friends were stunned that I joined the CIA. A member of my dissertation committee, a faculty member, got off of my committee. He was furious. He had come from the State Department to join the faculty, and he didn't want to be perceived as the conduit for sending graduate students to the intelligence community, and that led to some terrible feelings. And I have to say that I looked at the CIA as an intelligence organization, and I downplayed the operational role. I'm not going to try to defend that decision. I mean, I knew exactly what I was doing, but it was easy to rationalize it because when you deal with the CIA, you're dealing with two very distinct departments or directorates. An operations directorate, which is covert, people working undercover, clandestine, and an intelligence directorate that's quite overt. And you have vast differences in the two directorates. The intelligence directorate was rather liberal. When I joined in 66, I was a protester of the war. I was involved in the anti-war movement in Indiana and the teach-in movement at Indiana University. The operational directorate was more conservative, more to the right of center. There was not a lot of contact between the two directorates. So I understood what the problem was, but it didn't get in the way of my decision, obviously, and it certainly didn't get in the way of producing very good intelligence, I thought, for the first 15 years.
I guess what you're saying is that there existed right from the start a natural tension between these two sides of the CIA, the operational side, the side that actually went out and committed coups and in later years tortured people, and the side that collected intelligence on which, for example, the White House could act based on that intelligence, decide whether or not to go somewhere or pull back. Was that very design flaw in the CIA part of the problem?
Oh, I think you've put your finger on the problem. The CIA likes to think of itself as not being a policy agency. But when you look at the failures you refer to in terms of regime change and assassination policy, and I need to point out, when I think of covert action, I don't see many strategic successes. Yeah. I see nothing but a series of strategic failures. But remember, this was not the CIA acting on its own hook. When Senator Frank Church headed the Church Commission in the mid-1970s, he referred to the CIA as a rogue elephant out of control. Well, the fact of the matter is, it was not a rogue agency, and it was not out of control. It was following instructions from the White House. All of these terrible decisions that we know about now, whether it's Chile, or I mentioned the Congo, I mentioned Iran, the Bay of Pigs, torture and abuse in the war on terror. Remember, these were directed by the White House, by the National Security Council. There were the torture memoranda in the case of the Justice Department that supposedly gave some clearance to the CIA to conduct these sadistic torture and abuse activities. So it was the White House that was at the center of this decision making. But in doing so, it made the CIA a policy organization. On the intelligence side, we were not part of policy. Our job was to tell truth to policy. And I can cite examples, important examples, where we were listened to in areas like Vietnam. And if you go to the Pentagon Papers and the role that Daniel Ellsberg played, and I was with him in Berkeley just a few nights ago, and I didn't need to remind Dan of this, but I did, that if you go to the annexes of the Pentagon Papers, you have the CIA intelligence estimates that said this is a no-win situation. This is an unwinnable war. Strategic bombing and escalation is just not going to work in the case of Vietnam. And of course, the CIA carried a message down to the White House that presidents were tired of hearing, and eventually it contributed to the loss of a job for Richard Helms, the CIA director.
So then, was it clear to you after you started working as an analyst at the CIA that the operational arm was the more politically, ideologically driven arm, and the intelligence arm was the more information, rational-based arm of it? So I'm leading up to the role of Robert Gates, who and those people who essentially have been able to politicize the CIA.
Yeah, again, you describe it very well. And I think from the time I joined in 1966 to 1981, I think the analysts were in the position of being able to tell truth to power. It wasn't always listened to, but I thought the debates that went on within the Central Intelligence Agency were incredibly intense. The discussions of Vietnam were far more informative and much greater depth than what went on the academic campus and the academic community generally. But all of this changed in 1981 with the election of Ronald Reagan, a very ideological president who introduced a very ideological national security team led by William Casey at the Central Intelligence Agency. We didn't use the word neocon or neoconservative in the 1980s, but if that word had been in vogue, William Casey was a classic neocon, and he introduced a deputy director for intelligence, Robert Gates, who became the filter for intelligence analysis.
And so then eventually Robert Gates became CIA director himself, and in his Senate hearings in 1991, you testified. What was the main issue on which you testified? Was it Gates's role in the Iran-Contra affair that was what motivated you to speak out?
No, that wasn't the key issue for me. But Iran-Contra was a key issue, and it's worth backing up a little bit. He was nominated to be CIA director for the first time in 1987 by President Reagan. And when he went before the Senate Intelligence Committee for confirmation, he got a call that night from the chairman of the committee, David Boren from the state of Oklahoma, and said, "Bob, I've got bad news for you. The committee doesn't believe you and your denials of non-involvement with regard to Iran-Contra. I cannot get your name out of this committee." And Bob went into the White House the next day and pulled his name out of the running as CIA director. But 4 years later, George H.W. Bush, and remember, in many ways, Gates was a creature or creation of the Bush family. They brought him great success at the CIA. They made him director of the Bush School of international relations at Texas A&M, and then the president of the university, and then, of course, George W. Bush made him the Secretary of Defense. But my issue was pure and simple. It was the politicization of intelligence. That is, the spinning of intelligence, or the great John le Carré novel, The Tailor of Panama, the tailoring of intelligence. That is, creating intelligence that was either not only misinformation, but disinformation. In other words, misinformation, it just happens to be wrong. Disinformation is designed to be wrong. And some of it was tailored out of whole cloth in some cases. So on a range of issues, particularly in my area of the Soviet Union, there was one false paper after another. There was an assessment linking the Soviet Union falsely to the attempt to assassinate the Pope in 1981. My wife is here tonight, and the two of us worked on a paper on international terrorism that we couldn't get by Gates and Casey because it didn't refer to the Soviets as running this Wurlitzer organ of international terrorism around the world, which Secretary of State Haig believed in and CIA Director Casey believed in. So there was tremendous amounts of false intelligence that was going out there to serve a purpose. You know, it wasn't just mindless. Ronald Reagan wanted to increase defense spending in peacetime in an unprecedented way. And the only way you can increase defense spending, particularly in peacetime, is to have a threat, that's 10 feet tall. And the Russian bear served that purpose. So the fact of the matter is, as my wife and I were arguing, and several of us were arguing the same thing, we didn't say the Soviet Union was going to fall apart, but we did say the Soviet Union was weak. And was in a very poor position with regard to the United States, economically weak, politically weak, militarily much weaker than the United States. And the kind of writing we did, we couldn't get past Casey and Gates. Yeah. Gates was that filter. So you had a combination of Geppetto, Casey, and you had Pinocchio. You had Bob Gates. To me, he was a windsock. You know, he just blew with the prevailing winds.
And of course, if you just think about everything you just said, the relevance to today is startling. And we'll get to that in our conversation.
My guest has been Melvin A. Goodman, senior analyst and division chief at the CIA from 1966 to 1990. He's an expert on U.S.-Russia relations, and his writings have appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, Harper's, and more. He's the author of 6 books on U.S. intelligence and international security. We're discussing his new book, Whistleblower at the CIA, an insider's account of the politics of intelligence. This conversation was taped at Roman's Bookstore in Pasadena, California, on June 26, 2017. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. Melvin Goodman was a senior analyst and division chief at the CIA from 1966 to 1990. His new book is called Whistleblower at the CIA, an insider's account of the politics of intelligence. We now continue the conversation that I taped with him at Roman's Bookstore in Pasadena.
Let's talk about what led you to leave the CIA. And I understand when you actually spoke at the hearing, had you already left at that time, just a year earlier? What was it? Was it Gates directly that sort of was the straw that broke the camel's back? Or was it many years of you grappling with seeing how the CIA was going in the wrong direction, in your opinion?
Well, to back up a little bit, Bob and I were very close. We were rather good friends. I took Bob to lunch his first day in the building, I think in 1967 or 68. I had just arrived in 66, and after that lunch, I came back to tell my colleagues, you know, we're going to be working for this guy one of these days, because he was the most ambitious person I had ever met, and he turned out to be one of the hardest working people I had ever met, but nothing was going to get in the way of that ambition. So the problem started with the spinning of intelligence in 1981 when he became Deputy Director for Intelligence in 82. There was one paper after another that led me to go to Gates, and finally, in a classic argument that we had that he found very upsetting because I used the I word with him, integrity, and I accused him of a lack of integrity. Well, that created a lot of trouble, and in 1985, he pushed me out of the position I was in, which was running the Soviet Foreign Policy Shop in the Office of Soviet Affairs. So in 1986, 5 years of fighting these battles and not getting anywhere, I decided to go to the National War College to teach as a professor of international security. But I was there sponsored by the CIA. When it was time to go back after various extensions, I made it clear I didn't want to go back to the CIA. So I resigned from the CIA and stayed on at the War College. And then it was the following year. In 1991, I was bringing a group of military officers back from the Soviet Union. That was the last year of the Soviet Union. And I stopped to buy a New York Times at JFK Airport. It was May the 22nd, 1991, an important date for me. And there was the lead story, George H.W. Bush nominates Gates to be CIA director. And I said, this is really ridiculous. I thought there was supposed to be no second acts in politics. I said this was a second act that I found impossible. And I made it known to the Intelligence Committee. I was prepared to come in and talk to their staff. And after three or four sessions with the staff, I decided I would testify in first closed session and then open session. But the great line in the closed session was uttered by an excellent senator who should have been president and could have been president, I think, and would have been a damn good one, Sam Nunn from Georgia. I was about, 15 minutes into my presentation, and Nunn interrupted and said, this is much too sensitive to be discussed in closed session. We can only do this in open session.
Wow.
Which I thought was a bizarre remark to make, but it's exactly what I wanted to hear.
Yeah. Was it at that time that you considered yourself a whistleblower, that speaking to the Senate about what you saw happening within the CIA, that you started to see yourself as someone who was going to speak out?
Well, I thought I went through phases as a contrarian and then a dissident in the 1980s. I considered myself a whistleblower in 1991 because I have a very narrow definition, a very simple, maybe simplistic, maybe even simple-minded definition of whistleblowing, and that is someone who's trying to correct a wrong. And frankly, I know this is controversial. I look at Edward Snowden that way, and I realize Snowden is controversial for many reasons. Chelsea Manning is controversial for many reasons, and I don't compare myself to the two of them because what they did was incredibly courageous, but they were trying to correct wrongs. Snowden correcting the wrong of massive surveillance, Chelsea Manning exposing war crimes. I was exposing politicization. And remember, politicization is a very costly transgression. This country has gone to war with false intelligence too many times. And it goes back to before the CIA. The Mexican-American War, the Spanish-American War were based on lies. The Vietnam War, the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, was based on a lie about what actually took place off the coast of Vietnam in the 1960s. And of course, if you fast forward to 2003, that was classic. Look at what the CIA did in contributing to the false narrative to get us to undertake the worst decision any president, not in my lifetime, in our history. The worst decision any president has ever made on foreign policy was the invasion of Iraq. And when you look at the apocalyptic nature of the Middle East, you have to track it to March 2003 in that decision. And it was phony intelligence, a CIA national intelligence estimate. October 2002, the infamous remark of George Tenet, the CIA director, slam dunk, Mr. President, I can give you the intelligence to take to the American people to fool us. And then the phony speech that the CIA wrote for Secretary of State Colin Powell that was delivered in February of 2003, only six weeks before the invasion. We bought it, Too many people bought the lies and the misinformation and disinformation that surrounded that narrative in the run-up to war.
Hmm. So in fact, in that case, where the CIA delivered the intelligence, in quotes, intelligence that the Bush administration wanted, who prompted that? In the relationship between the White House and the CIA, was it the CIA manufacturing the intelligence that it wanted, or was it the Bush administration pushing the CIA to give it what it wanted, or both?
In the earlier book I did on the failure of intelligence, the decline and fall of the CIA, I did this in 2008. I have two chapters in there, The Lies of the White House and The Lies of the CIA. It was not either or, it was both. Now, you can't let the CIA off the hook because of the pressure that came from the White House. There were things happening in the run-up to that war that were unprecedented. Dick Cheney, the vice president, and he really wanted this war in a very deep, passionate way because he was trying to create a more powerful presidency. This goes back to Vietnam and the weakening of the presidency during that very unpopular war. And Cheney understood that in wartime, you create a more powerful chief executive, and that's what he wanted for George W. Bush. He made about 10, 11 trips out to the CIA to put pressure on the CIA to create a line, a narrative to support the war. Lies about weapons of mass destruction, lies about Saddam Hussein's connection to 9/11, lies about Saddam Hussein's connections to Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. All of this that became the narrative was false. And I guess the tragedy to me in all of this is if you look at the young people, young men and women who were put in harm's way, and many who lost their lives in Iraq, how many of these young people maybe went to Iraq or joined the military because they thought they were avenging 9/11? Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11 whatsoever. So this was a serious war crime, in my estimation, that had to be explained.
I want to go back to a couple of threads that that we started to follow. One being Robert Gates, because the CIA director was not as far as he got, despite all of the problems that marked his career at the CIA. He ended up, of course, as defense secretary in 2006. Did you speak out at that time? And was there an attempt to just bury the controversies around Gates in terms of the testimony you had given in 91?
Well, I did go down to the Hill, and I lobbied. I went to, I don't know, four or five Senate offices, and it became clear that they weren't that happy with the appointment of Bob Gates. But they were very happy with getting rid of Donald Rumsfeld. In fact, I said in a couple of the offices that you look at Gates as sort of an abortion pill. That's the way we were going to abort ourselves of Donald Rumsfeld. Oh, wow. And they didn't argue with that. Yeah. And I think that was the mistake that was made in 2006. The unpopularity of Donald Rumsfeld paved the way for Bob Gates. Yeah. But my real complaint, being a yellow dog Democrat, is why in the world would Barack Obama keep this man on as Secretary of Defense? And the only answer I could come up with is Obama, and this is not unusual for Democratic presidents particularly, who are intimidated by the military. Democrats have the label of being soft on these national security issues. Obama had a very weak background in national security. That wasn't the strongest part of his candidacy. It rarely is for any president, for that matter, since Eisenhower. But I think Obama wanted to signal that I'm not going to make waves at the Pentagon. I'm not going to challenge you. I'm not going to change anything. You can even keep your popular Secretary of Defense, Bob Gates, because the generals essentially controlled Bob Gates the way I looked at Gates' tenure as Secretary of Defense. And this was indeed unfortunate.
The other thread that I wanted to pick up is the term whistleblower, which is the first word in the title of your book, Whistleblower at the CIA. It is a complex issue, you write, because, quote, it often raises the questions of patriotism or sedition. So let's talk about how you were viewed when you spoke out about the politicization of the CIA and how you navigated these issues of being labeled anti-patriotic, unpatriotic, or seditious, because those are very relevant questions today in light not only of Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden, but the newest whistleblower, reality winner who has been imprisoned and is awaiting trial, and future whistleblowers?
That's a tough one. I don't think anyone goes into the government to be a whistleblower. And I think when you confront a situation that requires some truth-telling, and I prefer the term truth-teller to whistleblower, but that wasn't going to make it in the title, of course. This is not a decision that requires some deep cognitive process or great introspection. You react to something that you know is wrong, and then the question is, what the hell do you do about it? And where do you take it? And the problem we confront now, despite what the mainstream media tells us, that the guardrails of democracy are working, I read that in the New York Times on a regular basis, the guardrails aren't working. You know, the intelligence committees aren't doing the job they need to do. The inspectors general of these various agencies have been terribly weakened, and they can't do the job they were designed to do. The press, for the most part, until very recently, since the election of Donald Trump, really caved in to the government. They were intimidated in 2003. No one wanted to oppose the decision to go to war. I called a lot of journalists in 2003 to tell them this is a myth, weapons of mass destruction. And the only reception I got was from the McClatchy News Service, Warren Strobel and Jonathan Landy, who basically took on what I was saying and others were saying too. And there was a reporter from The Guardian, whose name I don't recall right now, who did take on, but he had trouble with his editors in getting this counter story into the paper. So you take a real risk in becoming a whistleblower. Lost a lot of friends at the CIA as a result of all of this. It's a rather lonely kind of experience. The example of my experience with the New York Times, I think it's worth telling, because I started leaking information during the confirmation process because the White House was sending out some stories about me that were simply false. In fact, when the reporters took the stories to the CIA, they were told not to pay any attention to it. And finally, I got a call from a reporter from Time Magazine telling me what they were doing. That annoyed me, so I decided, okay, I'll call the New York Times, the Washington Post, I'll do a little leaking myself. And Elaine Cialino from the New York Times was the one I was talking to, and she, for the first, I don't know, four or five sessions of the Intelligence Committee, reported what I said, and then she stopped carrying my information. And so I had lunch with her afterward, because I had an agenda, and my question for her was, you know, what happened, Elaine? You know, you reported what I was saying to you for the first week, but you dropped me the second week. And she said, well, the answer's simple. It was clear to me that Gates was in trouble the first week, but then it was clear he was going to be confirmed. He would go to the CIA as a director, become a very important source for me. You would go back to teaching at the National War College, and I'd probably never call you again. Well, you know, there are courageous journalists out there. I'm not taking that away from that handful. But too many are too busy protecting sources, protecting access, protecting what the government wants us to read. And again, remember, most of what you read, as I said earlier, in the press until recently has been what the government wants to put in the press. And that's a real danger. And if you don't have whistleblowers, you're not going to have investigative journalists. You know, everyone knows about the work of Woodward and Bernstein and the Washington Post. The Post has been living on it for 40 years, more. But do we think about Mark Felt? And the interesting thing about Mark Felt is the White House knew immediately who the whistleblower was. Mm. And it's in Bob Haldeman's wonderful diary of the Nixon years where Nixon said to Haldeman, who's the whistleblower? Where is he? And Haldeman said, it's Mark Felt, we think, over at the FBI. And Nixon's only question was, is he Jewish? And Haldeman said, no, I think he's Catholic. And that was the end of the discussion. So they knew where it was coming from.
So let's apply this history to today, because so much is up in the air. We're living at a very, very tenuous moment politically. And what you experienced at the CIA has so much to teach us about what we can expect now. You said earlier that Barack Obama kept on Bob Gates as defense secretary because he didn't want to rock the boat. How do you see Trump's relationship, Donald Trump's relationship, with the U.S. military and intelligence agencies? We know, of course, he fired FBI Director James Comey, and that's been a very political firing. But do you see him also as being someone who is sort of intimidated by the military and happy to throw money at the military and increase defense spending and then just take their lead?
Well, I don't know how you intimidate Donald Trump.
Make fun of him.
His narcissism is so intense and profound that we haven't found ways to deal with Donald Trump, obviously. I think the best way to answer this is to tell you what my next book is going to be, and I'm about to sign a contract with City Lights. And it's Donald Trump's War on Intelligence. And by intelligence, I mean intelligence writ large, not just the intelligence community. Because when you think about Donald Trump and his views on science, on climate, on regulatory agencies, on the intelligence community, on the CIA, on the press as the enemy of the people, he is conducting a war on any institution, any agency, any department, any individual who is looking for truth. And I put that in quotes because truth is elusive. It's not easy to acquire truth, but the pursuit of it is very important. And what Trump has broken down in this country, and that's why I am so concerned, because we're in a very delicate juncture right now in terms of cover-up, in terms of lack of credibility for key institutions. Trump has managed to break down truth and trust in this country, and people feel they don't know the difference between news and fake news. He's been very successful with his domination of the news cycle through the Twitter process. He did it through in the election, and I don't think he was called to account for it because the press played that stupid game of false equivalence. I think they've gotten smarter. I noticed the masthead on the Washington Post since the inauguration of Trump in January. I don't know if anyone reads the Post regularly has noticed this. Democracy dies in darkness. Well, Trump is seeking darkness. That's why Sally Yates was fired. And if you want to go back and see a riveting testimony, and I look at her as a whistleblower, as a truth teller, Sally Yates' testimony on the 8th of May. A month later, Jim Comey's testimony on the 8th of June. The rumors now that he's going after Mueller. And what can he do? You know he would like to fire Mueller. But I think he's been convinced by some people around him, and who knows who the so-called moderates are. I don't know of one I would mention as a genuine moderate around Trump. I don't think there are any. But he was convinced that digging the hole even deeper is probably not a good idea right now. But his war is basically on intelligence, on keeping us in the dark. And this is very threatening to the kind of society we have, the kind of government that we have.
My guest has been Melvin A. Goodman, senior analyst and division chief at the CIA from 1966 to 1990. He's an expert on U.S.-Russia relations, and his writings have appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, Harper's, and more. He's the author of 6 books on U.S. intelligence and international security. We're discussing his new book, Whistleblower at the CIA, an insider's account of the politics of intelligence. This conversation was taped at Roman's Bookstore in Pasadena, California, on June 26, 2017. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. Melvin Goodman was a senior analyst and division chief at the CIA from 1966 to 1990. His new book is called Whistleblower at the CIA, an insider's account of the politics of intelligence. We now continue the conversation that I taped with him at Roman's Bookstore in Pasadena.
So at the CIA, your expertise was on Soviet Union. You are a U.S.-Russia relations expert, and Russia is very much in the news today. And I'm wondering if you can, as somebody who worked so many years at the CIA, give us your take, because it's so confusing, of what Russia's motivation really is in American democracy. On the one hand, you've got Donald Trump, a businessman who clearly has ties with Russian businessmen. He's worked with them to help fund, you know, his golf courses, etc. And on the other hand, you have new revelations of the hacking into American voting systems by Russians, very likely at the direction of President Vladimir Putin. And the Democrats want to paint Russia as the big bad bogeyman. And revive, it seems, the Cold War. So how should we be looking at it? What advice can you give us on how we should view these, the mainstream media coverage especially of it?
Well, we're dealing really with an inherent contradiction, so it's a very difficult problem. Now remember, I'm a contrarian. So let me give you my contrarian thesis first and then try to relate that to the problem that we do confront with Russia now, because I'm not gainsaying the fact that the hacking was serious. It was real. I know some people don't believe it. They think it was a leak, not a hack. I think the evidence is clear that the Russians penetrated the Democratic and Republican National Committee websites. There's no doubt in my mind about that. But you do have to go back to 1991. In 1991, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the United States had the most important strategic opportunity it ever had in the post-World War II period, and we blew it. And we blew it in terms of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. Trump appeared to be the exception, and I'll get to that in a minute. In 1990, my wife and I did a book on Edward Shevardnadze, the Soviet foreign minister, and we interviewed Edward Shevardnadze and we interviewed James Baker. And Baker and Shevardnadze told us the same story, that if the Soviets got their 380,000 troops out of East Germany, remember, we were trying to move toward German reunification and bringing Germany into NATO. And remember, Russia paid greatly for the defeat of Germany in World War II. We could not have won the war without Russia. We could not have landed at Normandy without Russia. Three quarters of the German military was on the Eastern Front. Three quarters of the losses were on the Eastern Front. So we told them at the highest level, the President and the Secretary of State, George Bush and James Baker, that if they got out, we would not leapfrog over East Germany to go into Eastern Europe. We betrayed that promise. Nothing in writing, but it was a verbal commitment. And it was broken by Bill Clinton and the expansion of NATO in the mid-1990s for domestic reasons, because he was trying to fight off a challenge from Bob Dole in the 1996 election. So he brought in former members of the Warsaw Pact. George W. Bush went further. He brought in former republics of the Soviet Union. If it hadn't been for a very wise statesman, to me, the most important statesman in the international community right now, the leader of the free world, you might say, Angela Merkel, who called Bush, who wanted to bring Georgia and Ukraine into NATO, and Putin said this is a red line, and Merkel convinced Bush to back off at that time. So in breaking the commitment, expanding NATO, and then George W. Bush abrogated the anti-ballistic missile treaty. I worked on that in 1971 and 72. It was the cornerstone of strategic deterrence. We had no reason to break it whatsoever. Our purpose in breaking it was to put up this ridiculous national missile defense that you may think you have in California and Alaska. I wouldn't rely on it too heavily if I were you, if you think that's your source of safety. But it really repudiated everything we claimed we wanted to do with Russia. And then you add in the problem Putin had personally. And whatever you want to say about the Hillary Clinton campaign, the fact of the matter is he was contemptuous toward Hillary Clinton for some reasons, from very specific reasons. You know, lying to him about the Libyan operation and what Libya was going to be all about. Getting involved in the parliamentary elections in Russia in 2011 and 2012, and then the role of an assistant secretary of state in Ukraine. So Putin has an argument against us. But what we do in this country, and here's my problem with Russian hysteria, is we demonize Putin. And as Henry Kissinger has said, demonization is not a policy. And unfortunately, Obama continued the demonization. We cut off formal talks. We didn't allow the Pentagon to deal with the defense ministry. We're putting a regional missile defense into Eastern Europe, saying it's there against Iranian missiles. Well, that was a science fiction scenario to begin with, but with the Iranian nuclear accord, why do we have it there? Why is it in Poland and Romania? Does Putin really believe us when we say it's against Iran? So there is an important issue that Putin has. Now, again, being a contrarian, Putin, I believe, does want better relations with the United States. Remember, Putin isn't acting out of any particular strength. You know, taking back Crimea, moving into eastern Ukraine the way he does, and manipulating that, and going into Syria, has been played by the mainstream media as a return to empire for Russia. I think that's nonsense. Putin himself said many years ago, and I thought it was a great line, and I happen to accept it, that anyone who doesn't regret, and he was speaking to Russians, anyone who doesn't regret the demise of the Soviet Union has no heart. But anyone who thinks we can recreate the Soviet Union has no brain. And I do think he understands that. Their economy is in trouble. His political situation has been challenged. I don't know how great the challenge is, but he sees it as important. He would like to restore relations with the United States. The hacking has now gotten in the way. It's a very serious issue. The CIA went to Obama in August of 2016, finally, with the information that they thought Putin was directing this effort. And then you had the three key agencies that monitor communications, the FBI, the National Security Agency, and the CIA in agreement. And January the 6th, you got the very important statement from these agencies and the message that was taken to Trump about the Russian role. And Trump has never shown any interest, any curiosity in pursuing this. So it begs some questions about Trump's relations with Russia, the murky relations of everyone around Trump and the key figures lying about their relations with Russia. And every time you look under a rock, there's a Russian angle. So how do you take all of these factors that I've cited in terms of their long-term interests, but yet their active measures against our democracy, against our campaign, to come up with what should be the proper policy? Trump is working toward a meeting with Putin next month when the group of 20 states meet. He's getting some advice from advisors around him. Don't do that now. I think over the long term, we have to reestablish a diplomatic dialogue. We are in common on a lot of things: arms control, disarmament, terrorism, non-proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, the agreement with Iran they worked on with us, limiting North Korea. They don't want to see nuclear weapons in the hands of the North Koreans. They don't want to see unpredictability near their borders. So how you get there is going to be very difficult.
Another sort of theater within which the U.S. and Russia are interacting is Syria. Earlier you said, you know, it was important for Bush to go into Iraq in part because war makes a more powerful president. And we saw when Trump lobbed airstrikes for the first time, specifically at Syrian government targets, you saw the mainstream media line up behind him. Suddenly, he appeared more presidential. But of course, one of Bashar al-Assad's main backers in Syria is Putin and Russia. What do you expect Syria to turn into vis-a-vis Trump and U.S.-Russia relations?
I don't think Putin is going to allow Syria to get in the way of restoration of a serious relationship with the United States. I don't think Assad means that much to Putin. I think he could walk away from Assad as long as he had some understanding of the successor to Assad and could keep the modest air facility and naval facility they have in Syria. And remember, these are the only two military facilities Russia has outside of the former Soviet space compared to 600 to 700 military facilities the United States has around the world. But the Syrian situation has gotten so entangled. There's so many wars within wars, so many surrogate confrontations, the struggle within the Arab community of Sunni states versus Shia states. It's gotten totally out of control. In terms of his use of air power in the wake of a chemical attack in Syria in April, I think Trump's people around him reminded Trump what happened when Obama didn't use military force when there was the use of chemical weapons. And I think Obama got a bad deal on that that situation because we ended up with a diplomatic arrangement in which Assad gave up not all of its chemical weapons, obviously, but just about all of them, and he never got credit for that. Because remember, the Congress wouldn't give him any support. The people didn't seem to be behind greater military activity in Syria, and the British Parliament had voted against doing it after we had some commitment from the British government that they would support us in Syria.
Let's finally sort of wrap up our conversation with where the CIA is today, the agency in which you spent many years. There is a controversy before Trump came into power, the issue of the Senate Intelligence Report on the use of torture in the war on terror, and the classification of that report. I know you were an outspoken critic of the CIA's role in the use of torture. Are there the people involved in condoning that and authorizing that torture, do they still work at the CIA? What is the culture of that agency today?
Well, it's worse than do they continue to work at the CIA. Trump named a CIA director, a terrible appointment. A very right-wing conservative representative from the state of Kansas, Mike Pompeo, a West Point graduate. Pompeo, to me, wasn't qualified to be a CIA director, and his first personnel decision was to appoint a deputy director of CIA. He appointed a name that's probably not known to many people, Gina Haspel. Gina Haspel was one of the main operatives behind the torture policy. When the cable went out to destroy the torture tapes, remember there were 92 different torture tapes because the CIA, like most terrorist organizations, remember the torture was sadistic. That's the only word you can use to explain what was going on. They taped themselves. And a CIA operative by the name of Jose Rodriguez made the decision, which should have put him in legal jeopardy, but it didn't, to destroy the tapes. Gina Haspel sent out that cable. So when you appoint someone with her background in an organization, I don't think you realize the cynicism you create within the organization. And I know that from the experience of nominating Gates in 1987, the impact that had on us at the CIA in 87, and then appointing him again in 1991, you create tremendous cynicism within that organization. It's not fair to the organization, it's not fair to the American people, and I think there has to be some reckoning of this at some point.
Well, finally, Melvin Goodman, how important is it for the CIA to return to Truman's original vision of being an intelligence gathering agency rather than an operational one that commits torture, overthrows governments, et cetera, and do you foresee any president in the future, let's put Trump aside, but any president in the future taking this on? Because unfortunately, most of us here in the United States just don't pay enough attention to foreign policy anymore. We, maybe it's because there's no draft. We have blinders on often, and the CIA continues to be able to do what it can do because there isn't enough grassroots pressure for presidents to push it to stop those anti-democratic interventions that its history is rife with.
You know, when you talk to congressional staffers, they tell you they get a lot of phone calls about domestic matters, you know, planes flying over their houses from nearby airports. They rarely get calls on foreign policy, rarely get calls on national security, rarely get calls on arms control. So that when their principals get to vote, they feel it's a free vote because their constituents aren't watching them. That's one problem. We have dropped the ball on this. We have made a huge mistake in being AWOL in these discussions. But two, there's a problem at the CIA that it has turned into more of a paramilitary organization.
Yeah.
It's much too involved in military affairs. There's been a militarization of the intelligence community generally. And then the third factor, you have presidents who find it very easy to manipulate the CIA. It's a cheap instrument. It's not like using the Pentagon. It's not like commanding large numbers forces. And people forget that when we succeeded in Afghanistan immediately after 9/11, we did it in a 60-day period, October, November, December, I guess, in 2001, with 450 special operatives from the CIA and special forces from the Pentagon. At that point, we should have turned the keys back over to the Afghans. Al-Qaeda was out of the country. They went into hiding in Pakistan. The Taliban was forced out of Kabul. It's 16, 17 years later. We're on this fool's errand in Afghanistan. So this
the longest war in history
in an area of no strategic significance whatsoever to the United States. There is nothing to be gained in Afghanistan on any level. It's a problem for its neighbors. Let its neighbors deal with it. But look at what Trump has done. He's just turned over decision-making to the Secretary of Defense, a retired four-star general, who's now pointing toward another increment of troops. If we couldn't do it with 115,000 troops in Afghanistan, what in the hell are we going to do there with, we now have 8,500, add another 3,000, what are we going to do with 11,500? So until we wake up and start to put pressure on our elected representatives, get active, it's not going to change.
And of course, the CIA does all of this with our tax dollars. This is our money. Melvin Goodman, thank you so much for spending this time with us. Appreciate
thank
it.
You. Thank you very much. Thank you.
My guest has been Melvin A. Goodman, senior analyst and division chief at the CIA from 1966 to 1990. He's the author of 6 books on U.S. intelligence and international security. And we've been discussing his new book, Whistleblower at the CIA, an insider's account of the politics of intelligence. This conversation was taped at Roman's Bookstore in Pasadena, California on June 26, 2017. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kolhatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band, Kitsap. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files. We'll be right back.